always knew I was doing the right thing. Because you have a steadiness about you. And I believe in you. But it comes soon. And you must be smarter than your enemy.
What are you trying to say?
The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body is cold. You do it a million times. And they never get it because the real solution always eludes them.
What is?
Do nothing.
Nothing.
Nada. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.
And the Wonder Dog! Terrific! I'm Tom Terrific, greatest hero ever. Terrific is the name for me, cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here on the 1st of January, 2014, Thursday. And are you ready to go? I was thinking about putting one of my past shows on today, but there's not too much going on around here, so I thought I'd do another whack at Adolf Hitler, the father of Israel, so we can get that moving along. I've had a few comments and a few people that were a little shocked at some of the things that this book unearthed. You see all these connections with the Jews that the not only Hitler but the people in the Third Reich had at the top. The banking, the money, this crazy ass doctor that worked on Adolf and all that kind of stuff. Of course, I don't believe he was Jewish, but he did more damage than probably most Jews did. So let's get at it. Adolf Hitler, the father of Israel. Both chiefs, Canaris and Heydrich, knew that they are competitors in keeping their dossiers, which could reveal their Jewishness, deep in a safe. At this neighbor's party, they were not in conflict with each other. So in the evening, Canaris cooked a slew of La Marine for both families, and Heydrich played on a violin a tune called A Little Night Music of Mozart. Very humble for this occasion. And the unwanted and marked with yellow star fugitives hid in the corners of the cable cars, movie theaters, and grocery stores. It was very, very rare now that a German dared to pat someone's shoulder, even if that someone was recognized as a former friend when he or she wears the star, like the Iron Cross first class for bravery, unquote. Especially unwanted and marked, even before the yellow star was implemented, were the Jews in Switzerland. In 1935, the need for marking was already explained for Swiss like this, quote, the rescue boat is full, unquote. By orders from Bern, the Swiss consulates in Germany stamped a red J on the first page of a passport when a Jew applied for immigration. In this way, Jews were identified and their journey kept under control. Even during the war, when people were talking about annihilation of the Jews, the Swiss issued an order for the border police to check baggage of those who crept over the border from France or Germany. Only those whose luggage contained 100,000 francs or an equivalent value in jewelry were allowed to stay in Switzerland. Many of them returned back to their home in the Reich, while the border police were mocking and saying, which was not lost in meaning, "No money, no Switzerland." Oh, money again, huh? A few years ago, in the 60s, a Swiss newspaper wrote of the old man who lived his last days from tutoring. During the war, he was a police officer who falsified identification documents and thus helped over 3,000 refugees to survive. When this scheme was discovered, he was fired. A quarter century later, the Swiss government offered him a compensation, but the brave one did not accept it. On May 13, 1939, Captain Gustav Schroeder left with his motorboat, St. Louis, the harbor of Hamburg. The boat was loaded with 900 Jews who bought Cuban passports, delivered by a Cuban for $1,000 each. Quote, "You have to understand the price," unquote, explained the man. Quote, "There is a whole lot of mafia I have to bribe," unquote. And I guess who was in the mafia? You think it was all Italians? Well, just as many Jews. In Havana, Captain Schroeder talked to the officials until his mouth went dry, but it didn't help any. Nobody got off the boat. The passports were false. To Havana came the lawyer Brenson from a Jewish help agency in New York with a $450,000 gift for the president of Cuba, Laredo Brew, but he refused to accept it, for the law had to be observed. Then Brenson asked President Roosevelt for permission to enter these desperate people into the United States, who at that moment were waiting on the open ocean. President Roosevelt referred their case to his good offices without any results whatsoever. In other words, the president refused. So these poor people, who at the moment had a great hope, only saw the Statue of Liberty from a distance at the entrance to New York Harbor. As they were lucky, they did not understand what the inscription on the statue read. Quote, "Give me your tired, your poor. Send these homeless, tempest-tossed to me." That was added on to the Statue of Liberty by Emma Lazarus, a Jewess. Having no choice, Schroeder turned the St. Louis with its people, tired of Europe, onto the eastern course, back to where they came from, where they could not set their feet on the land in America. Gee. Who was doing that? Couldn't have been the National Socialists. They didn't have any power in the United States, and there wasn't that many of them. So guess where most of that came from? The Christians. Mm-hmm. Before the war, Germans tried to push the immigrants from Poland over their eastern borders. But Poland, for a while, declined to take them in by using a bureaucratic trick. Passports of all Polish citizens living abroad were invalidated. They had to be renewed. When a Polish citizen of Mosaic persuasion went full of hope to the Polish consulates in Germany, their disappointment was enormous, for their passports would not be extended. And so they became stateless. And as such, their deportation by Heydrich's police was with the extradition threat of German citizens from their country. Almost 1 year later, Poland was conquered. Its warfare with the Germans lasted only a few weeks. According to an agreement which was made shortly before the war, Poland was divided between the Soviet Union and the German Reich. The star attorney, Hans Frank, a half-Jewish searcher of his Führer's ancestors, moved into the Krakow's castle of the Polish kings and acted as if he was a vice king. His new title was Governor General and Reich's Minister. Others called him a Polish butcher. Then Heydrich and Eichmann forced their way into his domain of the general province of Poland with an attempt to create a state within a state, the Jewish state within the Polish body, the gubernia. They chose the district of Radom, as Eichmann postulated. We told ourselves that it was given to us. Again, we said, why not resettle the Poles, for not too many settlements are there anyway. So to the Jews, we'll be given a big territory, especially for the Eastern Jews, who are extremely talented artisans, needing only a source of work. Also, this will be a territory for Jews from Austria and Germany, Czechoslovakia, Böhmen, and from the protectorate of Mähren, and with a developed agriculture, such will be a solution for a while. For a while meant until Palestine will be ready to take them in. Those who arrived there were scared, first by Eichmann and later other founders of this remarkable state within a state. They were told, quote, here the Führer gave the Jews a new homeland. There are no apartments, no houses. If you will build them, then you will have a roof over your head. The wells in this entire region are contaminated. There is an epidemic of cholera, dysentery, and typhoid. If you will drill deep into the ground and find water, you will have water. After such a fearful introduction, which, nota bene, did not reflect the reality, to the half-prisoners was shown a new nearby border with Russia. Following shots from the machine guns into the air underscored the seriousness of their situation. So after a first or second night, some healthy people went deep into the Russia. First, they had to make their journey through the part of Poland occupied by the Soviets. A few weeks later, they found each other in the Siberian camps under a suspicion of espionage or other crimes. After the war, the German prisoners of war, together with those Jewish survivors from Vienna and Böhmen, had a lot of opportunity to think about past events. In the spring of 1940, the General Governor Frank found out what was going on at the border and yelled out with outrage, General Gumania has to just as free as of the Jews as the Reich. Recklessly, he chased them back to where they came from. The Jews who just built houses out of wood and rocks, and who previously, with refugee helper Eichmann, fled from Poland to Vienna at that crazy time, went back to Vienna. It was much easier to deal with the Jews living in the regions along the Rhine, as, for example, Sarpfalsen or Baden. After the conquest of northern France, Eichmann loaded them into transport trains and shoved them across the border to unoccupied France. But there they also were not welcome, and everywhere locals were happy when these wanderers took the next opportunity and embarked on ships leaving to Algeria or Casablanca, and then disappeared somewhere in northwestern Africa. There only a few German officers were present who were rather more interested in the advantages offered by the West than in controlling the movement of the Jews they were supposed to supervise. Despite the objections stemming from a fear that eventually Jews would pass some military secrets to the enemy, the Reich's government allowed those who were willing, even during the winter of 41 and 42, to flee to Russian combat zones in the east. Still, in October 41, a ship ferried the Jews to Lisbon, Portugal. By then, the roads from Poland over Slovakia and Hungary into Italy or Yugoslavian harbors were already blocked. The fleeing to the Mediterranean Sea basin was possibly only through Romania and the Dardanelles. The German Navy controlled the Black Sea and chased Soviet submarines, which were interrupting free passage of the ships. There they escorted some ships through the minefields. The Grand Rabbi, Dr. Isaac Goldstein of Berlin, who lived in Romania during the war, recalled, quote, "I owe it to the truth to tell that we transported to Constantinople more than 30,000 Jews with the permission of the German Supreme Command on ships under the supervision of the International Red Cross. From there, disrespecting the laws of the English government, the Jews in great numbers were smuggled through Syria into the Palestine. Nostromo, a Bulgarian ship, was transported Jews into the Mediterranean Sea, was in distress because of an engine failure. Then its captain, Gorbanko, asked the harbor authorities of Istanbul for permission to dock, but they refused even after getting a message that the dysentery had taken its toll on the ship's passengers. So on February 24, 1942, north of the Bosphorus, this drifting ship became the easy target for the Russian torpedoes, and with 763 Jews aboard, was sunk on the Black Sea. Of four people that were saved, only one survived and lived to see the end of the war, unquote. Throughout the entire year 1942, the advertisements were painted in the Romanian newspaper by various agencies which offered to immigrants ship accommodations. In the capital of Romania, Bucharest, a Jewish immigration office and a governmental immigration bureau were cooperating in the same building and on the same floor. In a report by the Reich foreign minister, it was said it should not be left up to the ambassador von Papen in Ankara, as far as he thinks it is necessary, to inform the Turkish foreign minister, Mr. Newman, that according to what we know, the steamer Tarix has not been chartered for one transport only, but for several more to carry up to 5,000 Jews. And that at the time, on the Jewish part, the negotiations are taking place concerning preparations of rooms on the Swedish and other ships for transport of 10,000 more. After sinking the Struma, the Turks were still not inclined to make the human life easier. The government of Ankara, having been asked whether it will permit 20,000 Jews to pass through their country by train from Bulgaria, answered in short, quote, "Turkey has no sufficient means of transportation," unquote. On August 3, 1944, the three ships, Marina, Bulbul, and Mefkir, sailed out of Constance into the Black Sea with Jewish refugees on board. They were accompanied by German security boats until the end of the flank mine barriers. 1 hour after midnight, Soviet submarines attacked them and set the Melkir, which stayed behind because of a damaged engine, on fire. The people who jumped overboard were shot at by machine guns. The burning ship sunk in the flames together with several hundred Jews. Now, you see, has anybody, any Russian, ever been brought up to the war crimes in Nuremberg? Did any of these people, and they were killing massive numbers of Jews in the east, in Russian territory. Nobody's been hung, huh? A lot of these people are living here in the United States. When on November 28, 1941, in Berlin, Grand Mufti of Israel, Hajj Iman El Husseini, proposed to the Fuhrer that Great Germany, that in case of war, the Arabian world should not only be supported in actions of sabotage and instigation of uprisings, but also in forming an Arabian Legion. Hitler responded evasively, quote, "Any German declaration in this respect might be interpreted as an attempt to dissolve the French colonial empire." Hitler remained an anti-Semite, that meant anti-Semite Arab too. He was not concerned much with the French interest in the Mediterranean basis, but more with the Italian Mare Nostrum of Mussolini. Hitler did not want his influence over the Palestine solution to boil and to give up the issue of the millions of Arabs who were driven towards independence by their young leader, Balafric, and later danced to this tune. Jonas Bari, in his Here's Berlin book, published in Beirut, had written much about the Arabian hopes which were ruined by Hitler. Very terrible things were done by the Germans. The horror entailed entire countrysites and cities where European Jews still lived. Many of them went into exile. Those in the Eastern Europe who did not reach Romania or did not want to travel by ship through the Black Sea moved to Hungary at the beginning of the war. There lived there only 400,000 Jews. In 1944, the Jewish population in this country was over 1 million. In March of the same year, Eichmann came to Budapest and got in touch with WADA, a Jewish organization helping refugees with the counterfeited identification documents. Out of the three leaders of this underground organization, engineer Kamoli, publisher Kastner, and a merchant of the knitted goods, Joel Brand, Eichmann chose Brand, an old friend of the SS, who in 1933, after the fire in the parliament, got to know the German prisons from within. Quote, "I will sell you the Jews of Hungary," offered Eichmann, and started bragging about how many countries he had freed the Jews. Joel Brand remembered at the Eichmann's May 29, 1961 trial in Jerusalem as follows. Quote, "He said that he called me to offer a deal. He was willing to sell 1 million Jews on one term. Goods for blood. Such was his proposal. Then he asked me the following, but made a mistake which still rings in my ears. Quote, "What do you want? Men who are able to produce offspring." He did not say capable of begetting. "What do you want?" he continued. "Children or old people? Say now." I could not act diplomatically. I was shocked by this offer. I said that I am not in a position to say who should stay alive and who shouldn't. I wanted all of them to be saved. Then Eichmann said, "So what do you want? Goods or blood?" "I cannot give more than 1 million. Maybe more later." I was ordered to go to the Foreign Office and to get in touch with my people. He asked me where I wanted to go. I thought quickly, Switzerland or Turkey? I decided Turkey because I knew that there were delegations of various pioneer groups and the Jewish agency. Then he said yes, but he could not tell me yet what kind of goods he wanted to get. First, he had to go to Berlin for instructions. In the meantime, I was thinking about the kind of goods I might offer him. And then he asked me, actually, he knew what to ask, but only wanted to get confirmation. "You have here a wife and a child and a mother, who, of course, will have to stay as hostages until your return. Nothing will happen to them, and I will take care of them. This will make me sure that you will come back." A few days later, the discussion about the transaction continued. Eichmann said, "So you want 1 million Jews?" I answered that I want them all. So we bargained about this million. Then he answered, 10,000 tricks? That means 100 Jews for each truck, I mean. And that is cheap. But the trucks have to be brand new, straight from the factory with trailers and accessories, properly equipped and ready for use in the winter. Furthermore, he said that he would appreciate it if I could load some trucks with several tons of coffee, chocolate, tea, soap, milk, and things like that. He also said that he made promise to my allies that the trucks would not be used at the Western Front, but only at the Eastern. I was surprised and shocked, frustrated and happy, everything at the same time. So I stammered like this, quote, "Who would believe me? Who would give me 10,000 trucks? Happy, unhappy, all these feelings came over me. I cannot describe it." As a sign of goodwill, Eichmann let 1,700 Jews, which Kastner picked out, travel from Hungary to Switzerland. And there, and before the first trucks were to be delivered and Brandt were to return, more Jews in the amount of 100,000 would be driven to the Spanish border and left there. As a matter of fact, they were put onto 6 trains and taken out of Hungary, most of them in Strafhofs in Austria, where they survived the war. On the next assignment, Brand flew to Vienna, where he received from the SS a passport and a false name of Eugene Bann, a German engineer from Erfurt. Next, on special courier plane, Brand landed in Constantinople from a report written on May 30, 1961, at the Jerusalem Trial of a Century. We know how the truck deal had ended. Asked the public prosecutor, quote, "Were you arrested in Turkey?" Answers Brand, "Yes, when I drove into the city." Prosecutor, quote, "Then you went to the Aleppo to meet with Moshe Sharat?" Occasionally called Moshe Shertok, later became Premier of Israel. Info by the author. Brand, "No, I drove towards Jerusalem, towards Israel, to meet Moshe Sharat, since he did not get a visit to Turkey." Prosecutor, "When you crossed the border of Turkey and Syria, were you arrested by the British authorities?" Brand, "Yes, after I crossed the Syrian border and arrived in Aleppo, then I was arrested by the British military police." Prosecutor, "Where did they take you then?" Brand, "To Cairo." Prosecutor, how long they held you in Cairo?" Brand, 4.5 months. Prosecutor, "That was the end of your mission?" Brand, no, unfortunately for me, this was not the end of it," unquote. Prosecutor, "But you conveyed a proposal you were supposed to and never returned to Hungary." Brand, "Yes, I conveyed it, but was not allowed to return." The answer of the British Chief Commissioner of Palestine, to whom in Cairo Joel Brand was delivered, and which could clear up the matter out of the diplomatic politeness, was circumvented by the prosecutor. Lord Moyne, the commissar, literally asked Brand, quote, "What are you thinking, Mr. Brand? What shall I do with 1 million Jews? Where shall I put them? Who would care for them?" Because of this Lord's position, 2 young Jews shot him on an open street in Cairo after making his statement. The courageous and betrayed Joel Brand had a heart attack and died, certainly because of his failed mission. To a Democrat, there is no taboo nor a hot iron. So after an in-depth analysis of the whole matter, he came to the conclusion that in the case of Palestine, Hitler, Heydrich, Eichmann, and Zionists were acting shoulder to shoulder, and Chamberlain, Churchill, and later Bevin, which with the Arabs, who were suppliers of oil, also shoulder to shoulder. Just like the First World War had become unavoidable because France broke the treaty with Algeria and made Morocco her protectorate, so it happened with the Second World War when Germany violated the Munich Pact and transformed Czechoslovakia into the Reich's protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia. What the English and French signatories of the Munich Pact felt because of the German entry into Prague in March 1939 is best expressed by the note which the Jewish Soviet Foreign Minister Litvinov Finkelstein handed to the German ambassador in Moscow on March 18th. The occupation of Czechoslovakia by German troops and following actions of the German government have to be viewed as arbitrary, violent, and aggressive. The shock of Hitler's betrayal of the ideals of National Socialism embraced the whole German nation, down to the squad leader of Hitler's youth. Germans believed in National Socialism as the best device for their own country, just like the Führer claimed in dozens of his speeches. Quote, as a National Socialist on behalf of the national government in the national uplifting in full consciousness, I am announcing that, especially in us, the young Germans, there is a deeply embedded understanding of the same feelings and sentiments characteristic of other nations. The new generation of this young Germany, which until now only experienced distress and misery, and the pity for its people, own people, and the suffering so much under these circumstances, is far from a wish to inflict the same thing on others. Being permeated with endless love and loyalty to their own nationhood, out of our respect and conviction, we also respect similar rights of other nations, and from within our hearts we want to live with them in peace and friendship. They should also know that we don't honor any concept of Germanization. The murmuring of the people drowned the Reich's propaganda minister, Dr. Goebbels, in an ocean of outspoken advice and newspaper articles filled with arguments about a strategic necessity. Does anyone want Czechoslovakia just having been included in the German sphere of influence to become the Soviet's aircraft carrier? Goebbels beamed after receiving such a brainwash people boasted like before. Führer commanded and we followed. Britons had a different opinion. We can't do business with Hitler. A few days after the occupation of Czechoslovakia, they guaranteed the security of Poland's borders. For despite the German-Polish pact of non-aggression, they did not believe in its inviolability. A few months after these guarantees, the Second World War broke out, which took almost 50 million lives, most of them white. Hitler's opinion was to be prepared for everything, just in case. First, though, an accelerated buildup of the most modern military machine in the world, using the Spanish Civil War as a testing ground area for the newly developed tanks and dive bombers. Next, to the maneuvers of unscrupulous Reinhard Heydrich, who in those years, without the use of any of his own bullets, destroyed the military leadership of the most powerful opponent, the Soviet Union. When Ernst Röhm, the main opponent of an offensive but supporter of the defensive army, was Heydrich eliminated. Heydrich introduced a journeyman's art of intrigues and falsifications as the masterpiece of this political gangster. These techniques resulted in a slaughter of the Soviet military elite. He called in a trustworthy artisan from Hamburg, Alfred Nojax, who did not know what the term fear means, but knew very well how to falsify identity documents. He also distinguished himself during a bloody liquidation of Otto Strasser, who illegally ran a broadcasting station near Prague. This selected team dug up notes, letters, documents, and specimens of writings and styles and signatures of the Soviet generals in the 20s. At that time, Reich's army of the General von Seck and Stalin's Red Army were working close together. The watchful eyes of these two secret service men were concentrated on those Red Army generals who occupied the highest positions in the military hierarchy of the Soviet Union. In the Russian military language of 1937, the documents were prepared which evidenced understanding made between Soviet and German generals involving in a conspiracy to overthrow Stalin. With the Hitler's explicit permission and with the help of deceived Czechoslovakian President Benz, these false documents somehow landed on Stalin's desk. What happened next is known as the synonym Marshal Takechiki plot. In the span of 1 year, in 1937, It took a heavy toll of 90% of the Soviet marshals and generals, on 80% of the high-ranking and 35,000 low-ranking army officers who were accused of taking part in a plot and in many instances executed because of it. Under those circumstances, the German communists who fled from Hitler with Herbert Wiener left their hotel accommodations in Moscow for safer locations because they feared the suspicious man from the Caucasus, Georgia, who through cunning and brutal actions became Lenin's successor, and who could make out of them a tabula rasa, a blank paper. Khrushchev, later on his secret speech condemning Stalin, had confirmed these events. 20-Party Congress, 1956. One of the guarantees given by Great Britain pertaining to Poland, it became apparent that the Imperium did not care much about Hitler's offer of allocating the Eastern Europe to the Great Germany under a promise of not taking over England's possessions overseas by the German army. For England's 100-year-old policy of balance of power would not tolerate another strong power in the European continent. This divergence of opinion in August 1939 caused Hitler's foreign minister von Ribbentrop to travel to Moscow. Stalin and his new non-Jewish foreign minister Molotov welcomed the German very warmly. After returning to Berlin, Ribbentrop reported that he felt as he was among old party comrades. In a pleasant atmosphere, Stalin toasted to Hitler's health with the Crimean champagne and said, "I know how much the German people love their Führer." After a few days after, these gentlemen came to a mutual understanding, and on August 23, 1939, they signed the German-Soviet Pact of Non-Aggression, which in reality was a German-Soviet Pact of the Division of Poland. On September 28, 1939, the comrades Stalin and Ribbentrop put their signatures energetically on the map of conquered Poland. This map solidifies the pact with the blood of the Polish nation. The map shows the eastern half of Poland assigned to one comrade and the western half to another. In Nuremberg after the war, when the court victors was in session, the dark side of the war of attrition, in the original text it is the war of aggression, was too a delicate issue, as was the matter of war crimes. The judges knew how to conduct themselves, and so they prohibited all the explanations or arguments using the term U2. Simply, they did not want to hear this in the holy halls of justice. It did not come to an agreement with Poland. After all, not because of the English guarantee in a matter of the Free State of Danzig, or for the Polish corridor, giving Poland access to the Baltic Sea, to which Hitler waived claims several times, or to land route from Germany to East Prussia. To Hitler's more important, the fact that there lived a large population of Jews in the world and just across the great German border. Hitler planned expulsion of about 4 million Jews from Poland. Polish government even sent a commission to Madagascar, which, after its return, complained about the bad climate there. Foreign Minister of France, Georges Bonnet, acquiesced. Polish Foreign Minister Joseph Beck recognized that this question in the German-Polish relations is very important and decided at the right moment to make public the details of negotiations concerning the Jews. However, only on page 42 of the London Polish White Book one might find little mention of this matter. Well, as you can see, there were thousands and thousands of Jews that were transported to the Mediterranean and across, made it into Israel or Palestine. And if Roosevelt and these other people would have allowed them to have more ships, that it got them all across. But, of course, you had the Russian submarines that were torpedoing ships full of Jews. And then you had the fact that almost no other countries in the world would take the Jews. All these people that cry their eyes out about these movies, the Holocaust and all that. Bunch of hypocrites. So if Hitler really wanted to totally kill off all the Jews, why was these deals made, and why were they transported down, and thousands of them got on ships and got out of there and got across by several means with the agreement between the SS and the Zionists? Sort of blows a hole in this whole damn Holocaust picture, doesn't it? The day after the acceptance of the non-aggression pact between Germany and the Soviet Union, the statesman Hitler called the three-quarter Jew Heydrich to his side, for in Hitler's conviction, history never questions the victor. In effect, Heydrich ordered the no-jocks to appear at his command post at the Prince Albertstrasse in Berlin, for no-jock was always ready to commit any misdeed. In the meantime, no-jocks was promoted to the rank of SS battalion commander. They had had a talk about the conserves, what meant dead prisoners of a concentration camp. In the evening of August 31st, 1939, the Chief of Security Services, Heydrich, ordered an attack on the German radio station in Gallwitz, the Upper Silesia. This started the Second World War with the help of the conserves, no-jocks, and SS men. They dressed freshly killed conserves into uniforms of Polish soldiers and delivered them to the broadcasting station. And then no-jocks reported it into the microphone, quote, "We fired with our guns a few warning shots into the ceiling of the station and are transmitting this message through," unquote. No-jocks broadcasted in Polish a lot of unscrupulous threats and announced that the Polish occupation of Berlin was already prepared. When the SS men departed, they left behind the conserves with bullet holes in their backs. Next morning, Adolf Hitler, the Führer, the Reich's Chancellor, in the middle of a session of the German Parliament, reported about this event. "Last night, regular Polish soldiers were firing on our territory at 5:45 a.m. Their fire ricocheted. In the confusion, Hitler made a mistake, for accordingly to the orders, German soldiers actually got up early that morning and with their faithful hearts at 4:45 a.m. already marched against the disturbers of the peace on the dusty roads of Poland. Again, the noble Swede Birger Dalarus, in the past Göring's friend, tried to save the peace. Dalarus flew back and forth between Berlin and London, but it was hopeless. On September 3, 1939, England and shortly after France declared war on the great German Reich. When the surprised Hitler heard about Dalarus's efforts and that nobody believed in his assurances, he put his left hand into his chest and roared, quote, "Idiots, I have ever lied in my life, question mark. 2 days later, Chaim Weizmann, president of the Jewish Agency, as it was known, then declared war on Germany. Quote, "In my statement, I wish to put a strong emphasis on the will of the Jews to be on the side of Great Britain and fight for democracy. The Jewish Agency is willing to enter immediately into an agreement in order to put into use all its human power, techniques, and remedies and talents. A lot has been said about why the English and the French in those first days in September 39 did not march into Germany. Hitler feared such a possibility, for then the whole war might have been finished within a few weeks. The German defense fortifications, the so-called West Wall, were only halfway built, and manned with 30 unprepared divisions consisting of old and badly trained soldiers. Tank and Air Force units were tied in Poland. Against these forces, France had at her disposal 110 well-trained and fully equipped divisions. England had already transported many divisions of professional soldiers over the English Channel into France. The day the war was declared, Churchill appealed to them on the radio, quote, "This war is England's war. Her goal is the destruction of Germany. Go ahead, soldiers of Christ," unquote. But none of them marched forward across the Rhine. The English war historian Little Hart later wrote, quote, "German generals were astonished and relieved that this did not happen." One explanation given for this puzzling seeding war was that those days in Western Europe, all the war cries were not founded on national fervor. The French asked to die for Danzig. Certainly they did not wish to die for this faraway city. And neither did the Britons warm up their feelings towards the fulfillment of guarantees given to Poland, or at least to her dictatorial regime. The expected campaign of 18 days against Poland ended after about 4 weeks with capitulation of Warsaw, and when on the 17th day of September the Soviet army marched into Poland, England and France did not declare war on the Soviet Union. At the end of the Polish campaign, Hitler offered peace, and on October 6th, in his speech before the German parliament, he asked the Western powers, quote, "Why should now the war take place in the West? To reestablish Poland? The Versailles Treaty, Poland, will never be formed again. Two of the largest states the world will guarantee of that." And with the last two sentences, Hitler was right. Western part of Poland became the German General Gubernia province, where Hitler's former advisor, half-Jew Hans Frank, became the governor before the year came to an end. 300,000 Jews were expelled from the West. East Prussia previously called the corridor of Poland mixed. Mixed SS, Soviet commissions on the territory occupied by Russians, searched by four ethnic Germans and settled them in the corridor. In order to wage war, ore and oil were needed, and in August 41, the English won the race to the Persian Gulf. In a three-day fight, they overcame a small Iranian army and found German Shah Riza Pahlavi was exiled to South Africa, where he died, and the Germans won the race on the Scandinavian ore, which mainly came from the Sweden. It's interesting, poor old Iran's been the brunt of attacks a lot back then and now. For the oil, on April 8, 1940, a great portion of the British fleet sailed out for Norway in order to stop delivery of the ore to Germany. Next day, German troops crossed the border of Denmark, and this country surrendered at noon. The king and the government were kept intact. Thus, the Danish North Schleswig-Holstein, which existed since the Versailles Treaty, was not annexed to the German Reich. After strong resistance by the Norwegian army and the Allied British troops, which lasted only a few weeks, Norway fell to the German hands for war's duration. Soviet Union expressed no concern about this development. The reason was revealed in a report which the German ambassador, Count von Schulenburg, on April 11, 1940, sent from Moscow to Berlin. "Our Scandinavian action has brought an immense relief to the Soviet Union, for the so-called rock has been pushed off their chest. The Soviets have already noticed the presence of the English and the French on the shores of the Baltic Sea, and according to Lord Halifax, Finland's question has resurfaced. The long article, which was printed today in the party's newspaper, Izvestia, about our Scandinavian action sounds like a cry of relief. While in the northern Norway, General Diehl's mountain troops were fighting fiercely with the freshly landed Englishmen. Hitler gave an order to start the war in the west at dawn on May 10th. The diving bombers and a large part of Germany's 135 divisions rolled over the borders of Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg on the way to France. One of the most knowledgeable English military historian, Liddell Hart, commented about the assault plainly, quote, "Hitler's armor was not superior as it is credited with. In numbers, it was inferior to the armies that it encountered. But the tank advancements made the difference, though they were weaker than the tanks of their adversaries. Only in the air Germans had the superiority, and this, as has been proven, was a decisive factor." To this comment, the Air Force General Student added about the parachute units and the heavy sailing vessels combined under Captain Koch. Quote, "The action of the Albert Channel was Hitler's own idea. Among other ideas to his was probably the most original. The surprise attacks on Fort Emau was carried out by a tiny section of the 78th Parachute Unit under Lieutenant Witzig. This small section undertook a totally unexpected landing on the tip of the fort and blew up armored doors and gun turrets and new and powerful explosive, which until then were kept secret. In 1940, the successful Ardennes offensive, which opened the way to France, Hitler credited to himself. Quote, "Of all the generals I talked to about the assault plan on the West, only Manstein understood me," unquote. Liddell Hart noted, "It was a bold undertaking to send tanks and motor vehicles through such difficult terrain, which traditional strategists considered impassable. Therefore, it was a big surprise, and the dense forest helped in blurring the strength of the attack." Of course, that's the same thing they did with the Battle of the Bulge, and they lost 100,000 men because of trying to carry on warfare in a pretty dense forest and bad weather below zero. Hitler's behavior towards Dunkirk, where he gave an order to let the British Expedition Corps escape, becomes only understandable when looking at the phraseology under the enemy during the 30s. Similar nation, German nation, and German races have to stick together. The commander-in-chief, Hitler, explained to his astonished generals that the British Empire can only be compared to the Roman Catholic Church, where they are both indispensable entities of great persistence and stability. So in other words, he could have wrapped up the war at Dunkirk, and he didn't do it. While Hitler philosophized over the 300,000 English soldiers were shipped by yachts, fish boats, and excursion steamers back to their beloved old England, and the Goring's Air Force did not harm them. Goring's Air Force could have taken them all out on the beach of Dunkirk, the whole 300,000, but Hitler didn't let him. Some less prominent historians speculate that Hitler only wanted to give his army a 3 days' rest, which was not his custom while his warfare decisions were at stake. Liddell Hart came much closer to the truth. Quote, "Many people who got away asked themselves many times, how was it possible? The only answer is that Hitler's philosophy rescued them, for nothing else could have prevented the tragedy. Only Hitler's order stopped the Armada when it was approaching Dunkirk and idled until the Britons reached the harbor on their way home. In 1937, Hitler let the commanders of his armed forces know that the Great Germany is just a prelude to the Great Germanic Reich. June 10, 1940, Mussolini's Italy declared war on already defeated France. 32 Italian divisions were not enough to overcome resistance of the three French divisions, which were situated at the Alpine Front. This, among other things, did not prevent the Duce to demand that the whole French fleet, part of Algeria, all of Tunis, island Corsica, and as the occupation zone, an area up to the River Rhone that he demanded. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I did want to comment one other thing. You may know Glenn Miller, who was with VNN, unfortunately, for years, after he got out of the North Carolina situation, killed these white people down in Missouri, I guess it was. And what it does is let you know that while these various VNN and Stormfront and these kind of organizations swear up and down they'll never be violent, it's people from their own cadre, even at the highest position sometimes, that do this crazy stuff, unnecessary and uncalled for killing, especially of white people. Now, VNN is still backing Glenn Miller. They backed him for years when there was all kinds of evidence of what kind of a person he was. And I got tired of telling them, so I gave up. So this is what happens when you recruit bad people. And they end up doing more harm to your struggle than anything else. Especially with Miller, he was an alcoholic, and his morals were not the highest, that's for sure, because I had inside information on him way back when I had access to one of the friends of his kids, and he was reporting to me what he was up to. So I'm going to play this little recording I got late last night off the radio. And all this kind of stuff just screws us all the time. It's got nothing to do with the struggle for the white race. It has to do with morons and psychopaths that get involved with the right wing, and then they go on out and do something crazy, like killing these people down there in Missouri. Can't get any place. They keep talking about VNN and Stormfront and these outfits, talking about we got to reach out to the public. And when they reach out to the public, they do something that's reprehensible. So I'll add this particular recording that I recorded last night on, and it makes you sick. Makes you sick. Glenn Miller raved about fighting for the white race for 30 years. And what's he do? He ends up murdering white people that had nothing to do with anything. 14:05, and I'll be back with you tomorrow on, what is the day? Oh, well, wait a minute, this is only Thursday. Well, I'll be back with you on Friday. Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the Bunker, She-Wolf Day. Yeah, 14:05.